Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Julian Farrer, engineer at Brightline. Julian, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Julian, would you like to tell us about yourself?
Sure thing. As you said, my name's Julian. I'm originally from Germany. You might identify that by my still pretty thick accent. Been in the States for a few years, and I'm a Ruby on Rails developer, and I work for a startup called Brightline. We provide behavioral health services for children.
I've had a disproportionate number of Germans on the show, either Germans or people of apparent German ancestry based on their last names. I like went through the guest list historically and like looked at everybody's last name. It's kind of interesting. So it's kind of like, you know, they say David Hasselhoff is huge in Germany. Well, Germans are huge on the Rails with Jason podcast.
We're everywhere.
That is true. Okay, so Brightline, can you tell us a little bit more about what you do? And I think today we're going to be talking about some scheduling stuff, and I'll provide a little bit of context from my end too, which is I work on a medical application, and scheduling is a large component of the app. And so, Julian, can you maybe give us a little bit of context from your end on what the application does that you work on and maybe how the scheduling relates to it?
Sure thing. So we have a Rails monolith that has two different responsibilities. There's a member-facing side, which one of our clients or a caregiver of a child can log in, can chat with us, can perform exercises, etc. And then there's also a staffer-facing. Staffers is what we call our employees that actually work on cases. Yeah, so we have this application, two purposes, Rails monolith, and we started working on this application about a year ago, 11 months, and the pandemic happened, and we were thinking about, okay, what can we put out there in 2 months that is useful to people and actually helps us to get the service up and running, get out there, help people.
Wait, what was the timing of when you started working on the app and when the pandemic started happening?
Lockdown happened in March. Working on the application began in April.
Oh, wow.
We were planning to actually build physical clinics and have people come on site, but it became pretty apparent that that's not going to be a thing for a while. So we switched the model to telehealth. Initially, we thought, let's maybe do this during the pandemic, and in a couple months we're gonna, you know, start building physical clinics and then see people on site. Obviously, it didn't happen. We're still in the middle of this pandemic and haven't seen a single person. So we switched gears, focused on the telehealth aspect. And the guideline we set for ourselves in the beginning was we want to launch something in, I think, 2 months. So we're trying to, you know, build an MVP, build the minimal thing we can build that's possibly useful in a way. And one of the components that we didn't build ourselves and used a third party for was scheduling.
And oh, you did not build that yourself. You used a third party for that?
Yeah. Worked great in the beginning because we didn't have to take care of sending emails, finding slots in calendars, doing any of that. We could just pull in that third party, synchronize appointments with a couple other systems like our EMR, and have the whole scheduling rules within that third party system. Worked great for the last year, but we keep hitting these limitations of the system that we work around, but it's pretty apparent that we outgrown this third party and now we have to pull scheduling into the application. So I'm very curious how scheduling looks on your end.
Well, I'll start first just from a high level at a conceptual level, and then maybe we can talk about some of the more technical stuff. But I'll describe the way scheduling works at our clinic offices, just in general. So each doctor's schedule is comprised of slots. So to make the most simple version of it, you might have Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. You know, one of our physicians works Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays. And then you might have between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. are your variable slots. And your slots are each 15 minutes. And so when somebody logs in and looks at the schedule, they just see all these 15-minute slots on those particular days, and they can put patients into those slots. So fairly different from Google Calendar, where you can just arbitrarily schedule something at any time for any length and that kind of thing. It's very constrained into these slots. Now, that's the overall idea. There are a couple things that are customizable here. So I had mentioned 15-minute slots. That's just an example. The slots could be 15 minutes or 30 minutes or 5 minutes. And you can pick, you can't pick a totally arbitrary slot length, but you can pick from some options. Like it can be 5, 10, 15, 30, maybe some other options, but those are at least some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the schedules, and when I say schedule, I mean the availability schedule. So the idea that I'm available Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays between 8 and 5, that is something that can be set for an arbitrary period of time. So we might say from January 1st to June 30th, my schedule is what I just described. But then after June 30th through the end of the year, I'm available on only Mondays and Wednesdays and not Fridays anymore. And so those schedules are scoped to periods of time. And so what that means is inside of those time spans, like January 1st to June 30th, we need the ability to repeat that schedule on a week-to-week basis. So not a crazy amount of complexity, but non-trivial custom scheduling going on.
Let me repeat to make sure I understood that correctly. So you have this concept of slots, and then slots are on a specific day and time and have a specific length. Like Monday from 8 to 12, I have 5-minute slots. And also from Monday 8 to 12, I have 30-minute slots.
Well, they wouldn't overlap like that, but it might be Monday from 8 to 12, I have 5-minute slots. And then from 12 to 5, I have 30-minute slots.
I see. So you can only book a specific slot length at a specific time of day.
Yeah,
there wouldn't be overlap between.
Yeah, because it wouldn't really be logical to have them overlap.
Got you. Are your slots tied to specific appointment types? Like, are there specific reasons why some would come for 5 minutes versus 30 minutes?
Not explicitly in the system. what we do have is we have like retina doctors who have 15-minute slots, and we have a glaucoma doctor with a variety of slots, including 5-minute slots. But the fact that the slot lengths are different per doctor is only incidental. There's nothing in the system that specifies glaucoma doctors get 5-minute slots or anything like that. That's just a decision on a human's part.
Got you. So the doctor kind of says, I need 5 minutes for my appointments.
The specialty will lend itself to a certain appointment length because they'll be doing different procedures based on the different specialty.
Interesting.
Yeah, like just as a quick example, the retina doctors, one of the things they commonly do is they administer this medication called Eylea, which I've said on the show before is administered in a terrible way. It's an injection with a needle right into your eyeball. And so that's what all those 15-minute slots normally are, is you come in and you get your injection in your eyeball and you're on your way, and that's, you know, takes 15 minutes. But then glaucoma, I don't know what procedures he does that takes 5 minutes, but of course it's something that's even less time consuming than a shot in the eye.
Okay. Yeah, one of the limitations we're struggling with that third party system is we have about 15 different types of appointments that you can book. There's, for example, an intake session with a parent or a caregiver. There is a telehealth session. There's a quick check-in. There's a first phone call, and they're with different types of people, different lengths, different requirements. For example, you can book a caregiver intake less than 48 hours in advance for various reasons that we need time to prepare and make sure they like filled out their paperwork and, you know, provided the material we need. And we also have the restriction that certain therapists are only licensed in certain states. And there's also limitations that certain therapists can only take cases for certain insurances because you need to be credentialed with the insurance.
That's a huge thing for us too.
And that's one of the new requirements. The third-party system we're using, Acuity, which is a great system, does not allow us to scope down calendars when we try to find free slots. So we say we have these 10 therapists and someone's trying to book a caregiver intake session. This person is in California, so only 6 of the 10 therapists are licensed to work in California, and maybe they have, you know, Blue Shield Blue Cross, so only 3 out of those 6 are actually valid to take on that case. So there's no way of limiting the calendars to search to those 3, which if it's only 3, that's fine, right? You can make 3 API calls, see when they're available, but if you're having hundreds of therapists, it might be eligible to work on a specific case that doesn't scale well.
Yeah. One of the challenges that I can't help thinking about just globally is the migration from one system to another, because obviously you're probably going to have a certain level of completeness with your new system before you move away from the old system. And maybe it's possible to like gradually shift from one to the other, but usually, even if you can gradually shift from one thing to another, there's some point at which it's like, okay, we just have to flip the big switch at this certain point and like get way less dependent on this one thing and way more dependent on this other thing all at once. Where are you at with that whole challenge?
I hope that we can avoid that big switch. I think we identified a couple components that we can migrate one by one. One, for example, is sending out emails. You know, we can turn email off in the existing system, turn sending emails on in the new system. Another thing is scheduling, let's call them widgets, like giving someone the ability to schedule an appointment. Currently, that's handled by the third party. So we just redirect them to their website. They fill out they pick a slot and fill out the information. But we could also do that. You know, we can have our own form and then just make an API call to book the actual appointment. So that would be the second step. The third one that's the most complex one is finding availability, because Acuity supports this very generous rule system around who can book what at what time and how much time you need in advance, et cetera, and when things can be canceled. And I'm not sure we can break that down much further. One thought I have is maybe we can pull in checking for availability without actually configuring these rules in our local system. So we would make API calls, cache the results locally in some data structure, and then be able to query that data structure. Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. But yeah, it's pretty complex, at least from my perspective. What we can get back from Acuity is essentially per appointment type, per day, per employee, a list of slots. So we have, 15 appointment types. Let's say, just for math, 10 employees. So that's 150 API calls we have to make per day.
Oh, wow.
That we want to show slots. So if someone wants to book something 2 weeks in advance, we would have to make 14 times 15 times 10 calls to cache that stuff.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And so things that's a non-trivial challenge, of course.
Yeah. I think the biggest challenge with that is that we block times and calendars by our employees updating their Google Calendar. So someone says, oh, I'm actually not available in this time where I have slots. So they just make an appointment in Google, like a block, reserve that. And Acuity synchronizes or pulls that in before scheduling and just blocks that time.
Okay.
And there's no trigger for us to know that that happens. So we couldn't guarantee that a slot that's available in our database is actually available in real life.
Oh, I see. So how are you going to come at this whole project, and what stage are you at now? Are you just at the planning phases, or has implementation actually begun?
Implementation has not begun. It's not a fleshed out project at this point. We expanded to new states recently. So we had this new challenge of, Acuity doesn't allow us to limit appointments to specific states or limit availability to specific states. And the workaround for that was just, let's add the same amount of appointment types for the new state we went to. So we now have 10 appointment types that are US-wide that are not scoped to specific licensing requirements. We have 5 California appointment types that are scoped to California, and we have 5 for Massachusetts. That's our second state. And for every state we keep adding, we're going to keep adding these 5 appointment types in Acuity. New requirement that just came in is we start cooperating with insurances. So we now have these requirements of our therapists needing to be credentialed with insurances. So we would have to add another, per insurance, would have to add another 5 appointment types per state. So it would be per state, 50 states, 5 appointment types. Not really manageable.
Yeah.
So we have not made a dedicated project out of this. This is just a requirement coming from another project. And the quick workaround for this might be, we're just adding one insurance now. So we might just, bite the bullet and add these 5 or 10 additional appointment types in this case, and hope that the next insurance is not going to come in a week or two, but we have a little bit more time to find a more permanent solution.
Now, when you talk about these new appointment types, what does that refer to exactly?
For example, like caregiver intake, telehealth sessions, or a medication management session. Okay. These need to be per state and per payer, essentially.
Okay. And that is, so the insurance thing makes total sense to me because we have that same thing in our application. Mm-hmm. In our application, the insurance part is kind of decoupled from the scheduling part. The way it works is you have the patients on the schedule, and the insurance stuff, at least from a technical perspective, is not a prerequisite to making the appointment. But what we do is we have like a yes-no indicator on each individual appointment that says this person is eligible to get their medication or they're not. And if they're not, then we need to call or whatever. It's not exactly that they're eligible or not. It's do we know they're eligible or do we not know they're eligible? And if we don't know they're eligible, we need to take the necessary steps to find out if they're eligible. And so somebody will, in advance of the appointments, they'll just go through the schedule for, let's say, tomorrow, and they'll just go down the list and say, okay, these 31 appointments are green, but these four are red, and so those ones need attention, and so I'm going to do that. So that's our eligibility part, and it's separate from the scheduling in a way.
That makes sense. I think the additional requirement we have is that I assume your whole organization partners with a specific insurance. Like every doctor in your org can see patients for insurance A.
No, it's just, I don't know exactly how that works, but there's not just one single insurance company that we work with. There's quite a large number of them.
Let me rephrase. I think every insurance company you work with is going to pay regardless which of your doctors is going to see the patient.
Oh, that is my understanding, yes.
Yeah, that is not the case for us.
Yeah, okay.
So we need to know before we schedule who we can schedule with, essentially.
I see. That's a whole different dimension of complexity.
Yeah, it's definitely a pain right now.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, yeah, so you need to, for each patient, you need to say, okay, what's your insurance? All right, your insurance is X. Let's find our providers who are compatible with X.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Okay. And so, you know, what do you think is next for you? Are you going to, and even in terms of like, are you going to try to start this project ASAP? Is this something that you might try to defer for a while? Or and when you do start working on it, what do you think you're going to try to do first?
I think my hope is that we can break it down into smaller steps and have a smooth migration and potentially push out the, you know, big switch over for a while. We are talking to the vendor. Like the dream come true would be if we could convince Acuity to add this feature we need and then just say, okay, we're done, right? Like we can stay with Acuity for X more years. I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Exactly?
That feature being, if I look for availability, I only want to look at this list of calendars, but ignore this other list.
I see.
So that I can scope it down to only providers that are eligible for this specific case.
Got it. Okay. Well, that seems like, you know, that's not like so specific to your use case. That seems like a pretty reasonable feature that other customers might want. Obviously, that's not the only factor in somebody making a decision as to whether to add that feature to their product. But it seems like you have more than zero chance of convincing them to do that.
I would hope so. It's not looking very promising right now. I think their solution to this problem is you add more appointment types. So you would say there's, intake Blue Shield Blue Cross and intake insurance B. And for most types of users they have, this is probably a good enough solution. For us, this isn't viable because we have this multiplying factor of state and insurance and appointment type. So we already have 15 appointment types, right? That's our base. And then we keep adding each per insurance and then another one per state. So it's a question of manageability. Like, they would support it. It's just not in a way that's manageable for us.
Yeah, you'd have to make some compromises and do some things you wouldn't otherwise do just to meet this limitation.
Yeah, we would essentially need to be okay with going into the UI and then, let's say we want to change that. We want to change from a 48-hour grace period to a 24-hour grace period for a specific appointment type. We wouldn't have to change it for one. We would have to change it for hundreds. So it would be.
Yeah, that would be terrible. Yeah. And when I said you might have more than zero chance of convincing them to do that, it might be very little more than zero. It might be a 0.001% chance. And the most likely thing is you'll just have to, like you said, bite the bullet and do the switch over.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's tough. Any way you slice it is probably going to be it'll take a large degree of care. It's not something that you can just do very cavalierly.
And by that, you're meaning just, start working on stuff and putting it out. You mean like there has to be a more thorough migration plan?
Yeah, exactly. Like there's features that are easy and there's features that are hard. And then there's features that are like easy, but they require a high amount of care. It's like changing your domain name is easy, but you wouldn't just change your domain name at 10:30 on a Tuesday, like that's something where it's like, whoa, hang on. Like, let's think through what this really is. And like, let's do it on a weekend, and like afterwards, let's like hammer everything really hard to make sure nothing went wrong. It's an easy change, but it requires a lot of care. And this is actually maybe both. It requires a lot of care and it's really hard.
Yeah, you're not motivating me here.
I am sorry.
No, it's all good. I think it's an exciting problem. I think what makes this hard, actually, it's not necessarily aligned with business priorities, right? Like, scheduling works. Why do we have to spend weeks rebuilding scheduling to support this one new use case?
Yeah, that's so tough. Like, there are sometimes things that are totally necessary to do, but they seem out of proportion with what it would be worth from a business perspective. Like, I recently had an issue. I dealt with this issue for weeks where I couldn't safely get a deployment out. And long story short, so I didn't know what the issue was for a long time, but when I finally figured out what it was, it turns out that when I was compiling my Rails assets, there was a mismatch with my asset digests. And I have not just one server instance in production, I have two or three. And so the digest would potentially, not always, but only sometimes, the digest would be different from machine to machine. And so that meant that when the load balancer saw the file name on one machine's HTML source, It would say, okay, I'll go get this abc123.css. It would send a request to my domain, but it wouldn't always get that file because sometimes the load balancer would route that request to the correct server and it would match and it would work. But sometimes the load balancer would route it to the other server that didn't have a file that had the same digest. So it'd get a 404 and the styles on the page would look messed up. And so this would happen, the symptom would present itself only occasionally, but it happened enough that I knew that it wasn't safe to do a deployment. And this was just a mystery for a long time. And then I spent so long, like days and days and days, trying to figure out what it was. And then even more time figuring out the fix. And then once I fixed that problem, it turned out that there was another problem. Without getting into everything, the other problem was that, okay, we have Sprockets and then we added Webpacker. Both those have their individual sets of digests, and both Webpacker and Sprockets, for different reasons, had mismatching digests. And so I fixed the problem for Webpacker, thinking that that was the one and only problem, but then it turned out Sprockets had the same problem. Anyway, that was a case where it's a looks from the outside like it should be an easy thing to fix. It's like the styles looks messed up, like just fix the styles. Yeah. But it took like weeks of effort to fix that, totally out of proportion with the apparent business value, but it just needed to be done.
Totally. Yeah, I think the hard part about this is anticipating this, and so you can, like, you know, actually make time for it and put it on a project roadmap. Rather than these things just coming up out of the blue and it's like, yep, thought this is going to take a day and now we're going to, you know, spend a month building this other thing instead.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good when you can at least have a realistic projection of how long it's going to take. Because that's the worst when there's something that you expect to take a day and it takes 3 weeks, or you expect it to take 3 weeks and it takes 3 months or whatever.
Yeah, I guess in your example, since you were solving a, let's call it bug, you didn't know how long it's going to take, right? In the scheduling example, if we decide, oh, we're going to do a rebuild, we can make some estimates of how much time we're going to spend on it and put that in. But the production issue comes out of the blue. There's no way of predicting any of this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, how long until that's fixed? Oh, sometime between 30 minutes and 2 years. I don't know.
We'll see. Keep you posted.
Yeah. But, you know, luckily, an attitude that I've adopted, or maybe a belief that I've realized, is like, those problems, if you just apply your full weight on those problems, you'll eventually figure it out. And it never takes all that long. Even if it's a totally hairy, nasty, really hard to figure out thing, if you just keep on it and concentrate on that one thing and nothing else, it usually doesn't take more than like a few days. I say usually, this thing took like a couple weeks, but I wasn't putting my full attention on it during those few weeks because there were a couple times when I don't know if I really like fully believed that it was fixed, but there was at least one time where I thought it was fixed and then it wasn't fixed. So that added to the whole cycle time of the thing. But yeah, and one good thing about your case is it's not as if you're fixing a mysterious bug. It's just you have to build a complex set of features. And so that makes the timing a little more predictable.
Yeah, sure does.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what else? We talked about... Oh, here's a totally different thing. We brought this up pre-show. We were talking about, I guess, my recent service object post, and you were discussing that with some of your coworkers. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. I think, what was discussed?
We've been growing the team, or we start to grow the team, adding some. We're going from 4 to probably 8, maybe more. And one of the things that I'm a little bit concerned with is, okay, how can we throw these new engineers into an environment they feel comfortable coding in and kind of like adhere to like certain standards and styles and like thought processes. One of the changes we made is we got rid of some directories under app. So we had an app services, which was not meant for service objects. It was meant for these are non-active record domain model objects. But it got kind of confusing because someone would, you know, create a Ruby object, and sometimes we would put it into app models and sometimes into app services. So we're just like, okay, let's get rid of this. The other directory we got rid of was our app commands directory, which were objects that followed this command pattern, which I think a lot of people like classify service objects as.
Yeah, and for anybody listening who's not familiar with the command pattern, my understanding of that is it's basically, it's a container for some procedural code, is maybe the most concise way I could put it. Would you agree with that characterization? Would you put it a different way?
Yeah, I think of it as a function as an object, so to speak. I think some people also call it method objects. Essentially, you have a single object, it responds to a single class level method. You never instantiate this type of object. You just call this one method, for example, you know, notify slack.call. It's stateless, at least from an outside perspective, right? You call this method and it gives you a return value. You're not instantiating it and then asking it questions or sending multiple commands. It's like a pure function with input and output. But under the hood, this .call method might instantiate an object of its own class that's then more organized, like a object-oriented type of thing. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and I've done that myself. Because if you have a class that only has, like, it gets called via a class method, you can find yourself in a situation where you're like passing around the same arguments all over the place to all your methods.
Totally.
And so you can dry things up a lot if you have that, if you have that class method, create an instance of that same class, and then you can just use instance variables instead of passing around those values.
Totally.
Yeah, okay.
So the change we made is moving all these classes into app models, because ultimately all they're related are it's part of the domain model, right? And the reason in the PR I tried to explain and I couldn't find the right words for it was, oh, we don't want new developers to be encouraged to only use certain patterns. Like that they think, oh, we have to use, you know, this command pattern all the time, everywhere. That's not the case. And I think you put that really well in your post with paradigm versus pattern.
Yeah, well, thanks. And let me say again what I said in that post. Okay, so first of all, service objects, it's a term that means different things to different people. Some people, when they say service object, they mean the exact same thing that I mean when I say poro, plain old Ruby object.
Yep.
And then other people, when they say service object, they mean something more like a command pattern object. And then there's this closely related thing, interactors, which is based on the interactor gem. And some people say the interactor pattern, but it's not a pattern. And what I said in my post was service objects and interactors, they're neither a pattern nor a paradigm. So a paradigm would be something like functional programming, object-oriented programming, etc. And a pattern is like a specific solution to a specific kind of problem. And then a paradigm is like a style of programming that you might build a whole application in. You know, like my Rails application at work that's built in an object-oriented paradigm, it's not really built in a functional paradigm. There's no reason you can't mix paradigms in an application, but the idea with a paradigm is you kind of pick one and go with it rather than a pattern where you pick things off the shelf and apply them to specific use cases. I think people take service objects and they treat it like a paradigm. They discover the idea of a service object or the idea of an interactor, and they say, hey, this is really nice. Let's write all our code this way now. And so they treat it like a paradigm. I think that's a confusion.
I totally agree. And my hypothesis, oh my God, can't speak anymore, is that Rails does such a great job introducing certain patterns, like, you know, model view controller, and it takes off so much of the boilerplate that people think, okay, but I have this one other use case, which is business logic. Where do I put this? And then they try to find a pattern for it.
That's my exact suspicion also.
Yeah. And I only realized this, you know, a couple years ago, that Rails is really powerful and you should make use of Rails as much as possible. And then it allows you to have more free time to spend on business logic and find the patterns and extract common things, you know, using many different ways instead of having to deal with HTTP requests and having to deal with like background jobs and rendering views and stuff like that. You use Rails for that, and then you can focus on your business logic using whatever paradigm and whatever style you want, but you shouldn't focus on doing everything exactly this one way.
Yeah. Yeah, my perception, and I've said this on the show before too, is like, I think maybe a lot of Rails developers, and this is just a guess to some extent, but I think a lot of Rails developers see these containers that are available. There's views, there's controllers, there's jobs. And then, like you said, there's this thing, there's all this model code, and it doesn't exactly have a container to put it in. And so they go looking for a container, and they find these service objects, and it looks like a container that fits the use case. And they say, oh, I found a container, I'll use this now. But it's not really an appropriate container. And the truth is, you don't need a container for that stuff. The idea of having a container, I think, doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I agree. I can see benefits in having these containers if you have a big team, where you're trying to provide standards for everyone.
I would even disagree with that. I don't think so. Because here's what I think a lot of people don't realize is that, like, we have this thing called an object, and it's amazing by itself. Like, an object seems kind of vanilla because it's like there, but like we forget that objects have all these built-in capabilities. It's not nothing. It's something. And so we can use that. I do agree with you that, like, if you're on a large team, then, like, you want to have some way to impose standards. But I don't think I would agree that service objects are a good way to achieve that objective.
I totally agree with that. I don't think they are the solution. I think I can just understand the desire to, like, find a container so that you can make it easier for people. And I'm not sure what the solution is. The solution is probably, you know, educate in terms of OOP and help people to, you know, look at good examples, give good feedback in PR, pull requests, etc.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's really hard because, like, OOP is really hard to learn, I think. And I myself have gone through this process of, like, I think I understand object-oriented programming, and then 2 years later, I decide that I didn't understand OOP before, but I do now. And then 3 years later, I decide, oh, you know what? I actually did not get it before, but I get it now. Then a couple of years later, same thing, and that just keeps happening and happening. So there are, like, these layers of understanding, and my code keeps getting better and better, which is obviously what happens to every developer. But it's really hard to just communicate and say, like, this is what OOP is, do it this way, because it takes, like, years and years to understand these things.
Yeah, it's not very natural to learn it. I'm no. in the same boat.
Luckily, some things I think are like articulable, but maybe they're not all that well articulated in any one place yet. Like, I don't know. Try to think of like, what's the best like OOP book that just lays it all out in a single book? You know, like if there is one, I don't know about it, you know? And so, well, one of the, okay, so I have like this long list, like I have an actual note on my computer of like books that I want to write someday, but like my ability to think of good books to write far outpaces my ability to actually write them. So right now I'm working on this Rails testing book, but my next one that's like on deck that I want to write, it would be something like Rails the Jason Way or something like that. Needs a better title than that. But basically, like, here's how I code my Rails apps, because there's not really, I guess maybe the closest thing out there right now is like Sandy Metz's Pooter practical, what is it? Practical object oriented design in Ruby. Yeah. Yep. That's probably the closest thing. And I think that's a really good book. I differ a little bit on some of the things in that book. I agree with much more of it than I disagree with, but I have a little bit of a different take. And also that book is a Ruby book. It's not really a Rails book. And so I would present that in a much different way. And I think that that's something that doesn't really exist yet so much.
I would definitely read it if you write it.
Well, thanks. Yeah,
I think one book that I read, also a Sandy Metz book, read it maybe a year ago, that also changed my perception of OOP is the 99 Bottles book.
Yeah, I have that book, and for no good reason I haven't read it, but I keep hearing that one's really good.
Yeah, and I think it's funny. I think the book would have changed my perception in a different way if I would have read it 3 years ago or 6 years ago, like just depending on where I was in my understanding OOP journey. I think it has different aspects that might speak to a person. I didn't read it for the longest time because I thought it was more geared towards, you know, beginners. I definitely don't think that anymore, and I think you might even like reread it in different stages of your journey of learning.
Yeah, I've heard somebody refer to books like that as a living book. It's a book where you can read it over and over and you get something different out of it each time, because what a person gets out of a book, it's not really, you don't get out of the book what's in the book exactly. It's a product of what's in the book and who you are at the time when you read the book and what you know when you read the book. And so like somebody who's just started programming a year ago who reads it would have a very different ability to absorb the stuff in the book than somebody who's been doing OOP for 5 years or something like that. So I can totally see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Part of why I haven't read that book is because I have a super hard time reading like ebooks on the computer. I have to have like a paper book. Which is funny because the books that I've written have only been available in ebook format, so I never would be able to read one of my own books. So that's a little bit tough. But yeah, just in general, you know, I put my service object post on Reddit over the weekend. And I got a lot of interesting comments, and one person said that, like, in his experience, a lot of people in the Rails development or in the Rails community don't have a very solid understanding of object-oriented programming, and I'm sad to say that that has been my experience too. And so that's probably an area where the community could stand to improve, is having a firmer grounding in OOP.
Yeah, I think there might be, Rails makes it really easy to get started, right? And I think you can get really far not doing much OOP in Rails and build really big systems and they still work. And I think that's what most people are, you know, that's what it started out. That's what most people are exposed to. I don't think that Rails prevents you from writing OOP in any way. Like, it's not making things worse or hard. I think it's just as you said, it's not spread far in the community. And there's not a lot of good examples out there.
Yeah. Yeah, because once you get beyond a certain size of application, it's like, maybe think of it this way, like, where are your programming skills at? What if you just had to write something in pure Ruby and not Rails, like you're writing some kind of command line application or something like that? What would that look like? And if you think about from programmer to programmer, how much that code would differ? Like, if you ask somebody to write a tic-tac-toe game in Ruby, and you asked 100 different programmers to do that, you would get such different results. And with me, the code that you would see is like object-oriented Ruby. And for other Rails developers, maybe you would see the same thing. Maybe you would see something totally different. I don't know, because Rails maybe it obscures the need to have separate coding skills from Rails. Because there's a difference between like knowing the mechanical workings of Rails. Because you can obviously be great at the mechanical workings of Rails, but be a lot less familiar with principles of code structure and stuff like that.
Totally. And I think that's the reason why people are looking for these like service objects or like this generic solution that like helps people think in terms of boxes rather than in terms of, you know, the problem in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about the problems and what's wrong and stuff like that. Unfortunately, I'm not sure how to articulate like, okay, so that's what's bad. Here's what you do instead. I'm not sure, other than just say, learn OOP, as if that's an easy thing to do. So I'm not sure where to go with that.
Yeah, I don't know either. It's hard to articulate, and I think a lot of this is just, you learn OOP over many, many years, and your brain starts reacting differently to different, you know, different code it sees or different problem it sees, and you think about the problem space very differently. I'm definitely not good enough of a teacher author to teach that to people. I think other people are, and I'm doing a great job. For example, Sandy Metz. So I'm really, really encouraging people to read these books and talk about it. And I'm trying to give very thorough reviews in PRs. And even if we don't change something, it's just like, hey, maybe a different way of thinking about this could be, you know, there's a missing abstraction and you might want to send this message to this abstraction. And I assume that what I'm saying right now is not useful to anyone because it's, as you said, it's really abstract, right? We don't have good examples.
Yeah. You know, what would actually be really interesting is like, I don't know how I could accomplish this from a practical standpoint, but if I could somehow persuade 10 different programmers at various experience levels to say, hey, here's a set of requirements for a tic-tac-toe game, go build this. And then whatever code I get back, I'll say, okay, now I'm going to refactor this into an object-oriented structure. Because I feel like that would be much more instructive than like trying to convey it with contrived examples and stuff like that. Because unfortunately, that's, you know, out of necessity, most of my blog posts and stuff, they use just contrived examples because that's what you have to do. Otherwise, it's not practical to write a blog post about it or a book or whatever. Because that's how you really learn, is like through seeing real production code and taking the, you know, if you have the standpoint of OOP is better than procedural, taking your crappy procedural code and refactoring it into something crappily object-oriented and then refactoring that into something that's pretty good object-oriented.
Yeah. Two thoughts. I think I'm not trying to upsell that book, but I think Sandy Metz actually is doing that, with the caveat that 99 bottles is not something you would build in a real world, right? But it is the tic-tac-toe example.
I really need to read this book.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. And then the second thought, you said, crappy procedural code. I have to admit, I do write a lot of procedural code. And I think there's a time and place for it. And it kind of like boils down to your whole like declarative versus imperative thought process, right? There is like a certain point in time where you need to tell something what to do and be very imperative. And to totally admit, I shamelessly use these command patterns or service objects quite liberally. And I think there's a time and place for them. It is not the solution to every problem, but I think there's like specific use cases where they make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Well, as I've kind of said before, I think there's a big difference between having a toolbox full of different tools and consciously saying, okay, I have a wrench and I have a pair of pliers and I have a hammer. For this particular job, I'm going to use a hammer because this thing I see is actually a nail, and a hammer is the right tool for a nail, versus only having a hammer and seeing everything as a nail, which I think is sadly probably the case a lot of the time with service objects. So I'm not trying to make the argument, and I'm not saying that you're saying that I am. I'm not trying to make the argument that like service objects or command pattern objects are never appropriate. It's just that they're not a good default choice in ignorance of all the other choices available.
Yep, totally agree. I think the key word here is choice, right? You have to make a choice, and you should make the choice every single time you start writing a piece of code. Like, you don't have to put yourself in a box with a hammer and then just keep using that hammer all over again.
Exactly. And I think that might be a great place to leave it. So, Julian, where can people go if they want to find more about you online? If you want people to find more about you online.
I occasionally blog some stuff at codetails.io, like DuckTales, but for code.
Okay.
I have a course about Docker online that's it aged well, but it's a couple of years old now, learndocker.online. And yeah, feel free to like hit me up on Twitter. I'm JUFAHR.
Okay, we'll put all this stuff in the the show notes. Julian, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Great conversation.